Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today I am talking to Rich Bartlett, I guess you would call him a black belt in social engineering. He's devoted his life to studying methods for creating decentralized organizations and offering those services to companies and groups all over the world as part of it's the Inspiral project, I think, or have I got the name wrong?
I've got so many different hats. Inspiral, you've got that right. It's Inspiral. It's also the Hum. It's also Micro Solidarity. It's,
yes.
Yeah, there's these like overlapping hats.
And you seem to be the main force behind Lumio as well, a piece of software.
Correct.
For decentralized decision making.
I was one of the main forces, and now there's other people that are leading it.
Yes, So that's my impression from reading the book that you contributed to, Better Work Together, which I just got through. It's wonderful. I'd recommend anyone interested in this give it a go. But do you want to tell us more about you from your perspective, just to kind of give people an idea who you are?
Yeah, I like this idea that I have a black belt in social engineering. I call myself a vibes mechanic. Mechanic because I was trained as an engineer. So my formal education is in, like my cell phone here, the hardware electronics, like how to move out electrons around in a useful and fascinating and efficient way. And I started Lumio, co-founded it with the team, being this software platform, trying to make it easy to include people in democratic decision-making at a small scale. So that started very much with the engineering mindset of, how do we build a tool that increases the efficiency of collaboration? And pretty soon after I started that project, I realized that like the technology side of things wasn't actually where my interest was. You know, it was much more in the interpersonal, the cultural, psychological, the vibes. That's why now I'm a vibes mechanic. So my fascination kind of moved off how do I build software to how do I build an organization that brings out the best in people, that reinforces our values instead of undermines our values, like a lot of organizations seem to. And specifically, like you mentioned, this piece of like decentralized organizations, which for me means non-coercive. Like, can we organize where everyone is treated like an adult that has dignity and responsibility and freedom, and have this freedom of association to collaborate with each other as equals, you know? Maybe specializing into different roles, but no one being in charge of everyone else. That's kind of the attitude. And I've just been pursuing that project kind of in some sense, like as a personal thing of I want to work in a team where nobody's in charge and everyone's collaborating based on their intelligence and their gifts. And then gradually the more practice that I've had in that, the more demand there's been from other people to say, hey, can you help us with what we're trying to do, something similar, and you've got some experience, can you help? So I've kind of graduated more into advice and coaching and that sort of stuff, which you touched on briefly. I think the vibes mechanic role is like, what is the subtle dimension? Like, how do we make harmonious groups? How do we create, what are the enabling constraints that set up groups to be fun and efficient and relaxing and effective and good at getting stuff done? And how do we flow effortlessly, or what's the minimum amount of effort necessary for a group to stay in this process of just getting things done, you know, in a good positive spirit, and what gets in the way of that?
And we talked briefly before, but I'm coming specific, my main specific problem that I'm coming to you to bounce ideas around with is networking amateur crop breeders who tend to be, it's interesting because we're starting like as decentralized as you can possibly imagine, because a lot of us just work independently and have like very loose, informal, occasional connections with other people who are working on similar projects. And I'm looking for opportunities and ideas to create more functional and more robust networks. And decentralization is the name of the game here, particularly with genetic resources, that they end up spread in multiple different people's hands, because inevitably one person will lose things, or they'll, you know, age out or die, or their life will get complicated. And figuring out how to, I don't know how to just nudge those networks to be more productively connected is kind of is my puzzle that I'm devoting a bit of time to. And one thing I really wanted to start out talking about is the issue of scale. And I have a little experiment that I did. I'm tinkering on the side. I created a Discord group for people that I've like encountered doing crop breeding who I thought were like particularly interesting, like particularly doing very experimental stuff. And from day one, I said, I'm going to limit this to 12 people. And once we hit 12 people, if I want to bring someone else in, I've got to look at who's already on the list and decide if there's someone who's not being very active, maybe they're not getting much out of it anyway, have a conversation with them. We've done that once for somebody who signed up, but then they didn't use Discord naturally. So it wasn't a good fit for them. They just gave it a go. No hard feelings, but I mean, that's something you have to work. But of all of the digital channels that I have, it has by far the highest signal to noise. Like every time somebody posts in that small forum, it's almost always worth me taking the time to read it and think about it and interact with it versus my own like inbox. My private email inbox is like 50% higher, things that I really don't need to look at. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about the role of scale in how groups of people naturally interact and the demands for like adding formality on top.
There's so much in that, just in that brief example. I'm fascinated by the dynamics of scale and how they affect groups, and especially at that small end, like around 12 and under, the difference between a group of six and a group of seven is profound. Like each individual number that you add like changes everything. So it's a real rabbit hole. I think like big picture, I'm interested in how do we become fluent in groups, like how do we become natural in groups. I think it's kind of part of our genetic inheritance as mammals that like we are kind of groupish creatures, and also we have all of this conditioning and education and culture and trauma and all sorts of stuff that kind of gets in the way of us being effortless in groups. And over the last, maybe 15 years or something, that I've been obsessing around these questions of how to play well, how to play nicely with others. The scale question has just come back again and again and again as this like common denominator that if we can develop a kind of scale literacy that seems to equip people to be much more intelligent about what they're trying to use groups for, and how they perceive them. So like what you've just described of we're just going to keep it down to 12. I mean, at very least, it means everyone can know everyone. It means there's a certain amount of shared context that you can have, and when Jim posts something that's a bit rude or a bit short, it's like everyone else kind of knows, oh yeah, this is Jim. Like he's just like that online, and actually in person, he's a really lovely guy, and you don't take it personally, whatever. You can have that kind of depth of shared understanding and capacity of shared understanding that helps things to flow really readily. And then at a larger scale, if you skip to 120, people can still have some sense of each other. The famous Dunbar number of 150. It's like, what exactly does that number point to? I think one useful way to think of it is like you can implicitly, without thinking about it very much, keep track of IOUs and favors and who's a good contributor and who's a bit of a freeloader. You can kind of keep track at that level of detail around 150 people. But you start to lose the nuance and the detail, and you can't expect that Sally knows that Jim is grumpy sometimes, but you don't have to take him seriously. And it's much more likely that those kind of interactions are going to blow up into conflict, or as you were kind of hinting with your email inbox, it's not conflict, but it's kind of apathy, or like, it's not really worth my time. You have this kind of filtering and prioritizing. So definitely the scale dynamic is important, and something that I've found as I've been trying to support people to become more skillful in their work with groups is, hey, you've got to adapt your expectations to the size of the group. So like if what you're looking for is, close collaboration and intimacy, that's only going to happen with three, four, five people at a time. It doesn't happen with 150. That's like I say, a massive part of my work. But then what you described, there's another piece in it which could be scale independent, which is about the clarity of your invitation. So you as an individual person with a clear sense of what's needed in the world, oh, we need to network together these crop breeders. It may be possible to extend that out to 15,000 people, so long as the invitation is really clear and the expectations and the sort of the protocols of how we treat each other are really clear. It is possible to maintain a really high signal to noise ratio when that purpose is really clearly articulated and the structures are in place to support it.
One thing I'm reaching towards as well is the idea of, like you said, with the Dunbar number, one person can keep track of, like, you know, 150 people total in their life relatively effortlessly. But if you can create like subsets of smaller intersecting groups so that an individual is part of lots of individual small groups, but then they interact with each other, intersect with each other in a way that can scale. No, I was doing some rough, it's a 6 degrees of separation kind of problem, mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. can end up networking massive amounts of people through relatively small number of steps between any two of them, with a really clever kind of, I don't know, it's kind of like a hierarchy of fractal scales of stacking everything together.
Yep.
So yeah, maybe you've like kind of done some imagining along similar lines.
Well, like just in really kind of mundane language, if you think about the way that a nation is structured, it's kind of built up of families, both the kind of nuclear family and the extended family. I think that's a pretty useful template for how to think about organizations and networks, that like you want to have these really tight clusters of, you know, like the family unit where you've got a huge amount of shared investment in each other's well-being and you can make huge demands of each other and you're obligated to each other. Mm. And then you have the extended family where there's the kind of like medium level of trust and medium level of expectation. And then you've got your neighborhood where it's like, well, ideally you have some common feeling and maybe you have a block party twice a year or something, but you're not necessarily coming to my house every day for dinner or something. And then the nation, again, you've got this like much bigger polity with much less depth of engagement with each other, but still capable of some coordinated moves, still capable of acting as a coherent, singular body.
Mm.
I think having these different, like if you think of it as a ladder with different steps, or if you think of it as a, you know, often I come to this metaphor of the body, which is composed of organs, which are composed of tissues, which are composed of cells. And there's kind of like the fractal that you mentioned, that there's like nested levels of increasing complexity, that a well-functioning group seems to be composed of lots of well-functioning subgroups.
Mm.
And, you know, when I say it like that, it's like such a kind of mundane concept, but a lot of what goes wrong in organizational design is they just haven't put enough steps on that ladder.
Mm.
There's you as an individual employee or a member, and then there's the global, there's the whole network of us 10,000 people, and there's not really enough intervening structures in between where people have that sense of belonging and they have that reciprocity and you know, mutual visibility with each other, and they're collaborating closely. But if they do have those networks of clusters, you know, these like tight bonds and then loose bonds, then it seems to stabilize into this healthy pattern where you find different parts of the network will play, they'll be like the different organs of the body, they play different functional roles.
Do you think that a lot of the problems of today are a consequence of scales growing so rapidly to such huge proportions that the tools for managing groups on those levels, like, are always playing catch up with the technology that makes them possible in the first place? Like, I even look at like communism, a lot of its disasters were from overscaling and over-centralization happening because of technological change.
Mm. It's so hard, isn't it, to like encapsulate what the heck is going on in the world?
Yeah.
I definitely, like my lens, I guess, is a lot of it comes down to, I always just use the shorthand of social fabric. You know, that this idea that a healthy, happy, productive, contributing member of society is someone who's like well connected, that they have a role to play, they're known and recognized, like they're in relationships of accountability and support, this kind of like checks and balances on them. They've got encouragement and they've also got a certain amount of like, I want to say like discipline or patrolling, or, you know, like there's people are kind of, they've got eyes on each other. There's like a positive kind of peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And that we seem to have been going through And it's like, when do you start your process in historical terms? Like, is it the Industrial Revolution, or is it the Enlightenment, or is it the Tower of Babel? I don't know where you start the line, but it does seem like there are some really healthy and thriving societies where you just have a density of connection. And a lot of the people that I'm working with, a lot of their problems stem from just not having enough connection, of being too atomized, of not having, it's like maybe I've got some close friends or something, or I'm part of a network or a community that really matters to me, but it's actually a very tenuous and fragile connection, because it's me and these four other people. And if something breaks in our connection, then I'm sort of back to being atomized again, instead of being in a more more like the mycelial web at the forest floor, this thing of like having multiple connections in multiple different dimensions of these different overlapping identities. I think that's what a robust person looks like, is someone who has all of these different group memberships.
It's like a social group where there's one person who always does all the organizing, and if anything happens to them, none of the other people really are that connected to each other, and it can all fall apart instantly.
And this is, I think this is a weird way of describing the Inspiral project, is like, can we make a group where most, if not all, of the people are capable of doing that organizing work, and are kind of at least have a passing familiarity with what does it mean to take responsibility for organizing a meeting, or a week-long retreat, or like a conference or something like that, and that we kind of take turns playing that role, so that we have an extraordinary degree of robustness in the relationships.
One possible combination of size-limiting groups to make them easy to manage and have dense connections, but to also make the culture or the pattern scalable, that I've been toying with is the idea that when you reach the size limit, if you want to grow further and you can't agree to kick anyone out, that you actually have like a biomimetic model of splitting the group, and then they're free to grow again. Have you seen any organizations use that kind of approach?
So, what is the name? I think it's the who are the people that make the Gore-Tex
Yeah,
brand?
I've got them on the list. Yeah, the Gore-Tex does that with their subdepartments once they
So
get
they've got
beyond a
a thing
certain
where it's like,
size.
and it's specifically, I think, as I understand the story, it's like when a factory reaches a certain number of employees, like when they're co-located, it's
Yeah.
like, under this number, people can kind of get along with each other. And because you have this closeness, you have all this informal knowledge exchange going on. Like, you know that it's Sally's cousin's birthday next week or whatever. You don't
Or
need a lot
there's
of
three people that
policies.
know how to fix that particular machine when it goes down.
You have all of this informal, implicit knowledge exchange going on. And so you can have a high degree of coordination without a lot of explicit infrastructure. And to me, high coordination and low explicit infrastructure is kind of the sweet spot. It's like the dream where, when it's not explicit, it means it's very agile, and it can really adapt to changing conditions a lot. And the reason that a lot of organizations are very unpleasant places to work in is they create coordination by adding a huge amount of structure and like coercive authority, and these rules and policies and frameworks that just prevent any kind of dynamism. And so you feel the sort of the whole the Kafka dynamic of like, oh, I have to submit to these absurd rules which make no sense, but like it's just the way it works in this organization. There's nothing I can do about it. It's from this static, where we create coordination by creating these static rules. If you can have if you can put in these groups that are 100, 200 people, you don't need a lot of rules, because you can govern each other by this informal sense of shared feeling, and like occasionally bumping into each other at the water cooler. With Inspiral, I remember a long time ago, like it might have been 2018, we had one of our like biannual retreats where most of the members get together. And at that meeting, we kind of had this sense of like, hey, we're reaching the point where it's time to do a cell division. Like, it's getting too big. And it's such a difficult thing. Like, a group wants to stay together when things are going well. It's so countercultural to say, like, let's split up in a good way. Like,
Yeah, and if you wait until it gets horrible enough that it's obvious, there's nobody argues that it's time to split and simplify, it's too late by that point. You've already damaged the culture.
And this is the, the history of the 156,000 different kinds of Christian churches. It's like we went to the point of rupture, and then we split up. So yeah, it was something like 2017, 2018 that we started thinking about how to do cell division at Inspiral, and it took, I think, like 6 years before we actually significantly managed to have multiple centers of gravity. So it started in New Zealand. I'm living over here in Europe, and we've got a real resilient European Inspiral base now that is like independent of the New Zealand entity in some important ways and connected in important ways too. And it's like takes a lot of time and energy to actually establish that cell division process.
Do you suspect it's a cultural process that will get easier with practice? That if you do this like 3 or 4 times in a row, it'll eventually become less traumatic and more expected, and some of the pitfalls will be
Yeah,
understood?
sometimes we talk about cultural DNA, so that there's these certain patterns that support healthy group function, and that we can articulate these patterns with like simple catchphrases and slogans and memes. So, for example, we've got a meme around what we call hermit crabbing, which is how we do succession, and the cell division thing. It's like we haven't quite done it enough times to have good memes about it. But once we've iterated through it a few times, I'm sure we'd start to encapsulate these little bite-sized memes that, like, yeah, like the catchphrase that comes up in conversation again and again when you're saying like, oh, it must be time that we do our cell division, don't you think? And it's, yeah, it's time to do it. It becomes normal. We haven't reached that point yet, but I can imagine that we do. And I think one of the roles that Inspiral plays in the world is to be a lab, be a petri dish where we are prototyping these new forms of cultural DNA.
What about limited scale in not in space but in time? Have you seen examples of organizations where from day one it's like we are only going to exist in this form for so long and there's an end point? And are there pros and cons with approaching groups that way?
They must exist. I haven't got ready examples to hand because it's so countercultural. Like the top priority of any organization is to preserve itself. It's so difficult to extend beyond that. Like at the survival level, the way that you described it, that an organization would start with its end date in mind. Like I'm sure someone's done it, but it's not been my experience. But you've got a kind of smaller version of that, which is absolutely essential to all of our organizing, which is not that the group is going to disintegrate at the end of the year, but that our agreements and our expectations of each other, that our commitments are actually time boxed. That I think has been transformative for us to say, hey, like right now, I'm in this new, we've just rented this big community hub slash retreat center. I'm in this like semi-empty room because we're in the process of setting it up. We've got here like less than a week ago. And what's going to be really important for us here is that, like, we have a meeting at the end of the week and we say, what was good about the week and what was annoying and what are the new agreements and structures and rules we're going to use for the next week, not indefinitely, but just let's prototype some new structures. And at the end of the week, again, we'll check how they're going. That process of breaking up infinity into these digestible chunks and having the freedom to make adaptations, I think that makes the learning process so much more systematic and efficient because you're actually stopping to make adjustments instead of, like you said before, waiting for the rupture, waiting for someone to just blow up and be like, hey, I hate this. This doesn't work.
Is it also a way you mentioned like cultural DNA as an analogy? Do many traditional group cultures accumulate like this legacy of all these old rules and regulations that are, and there's no mechanism for like reassessing and clearing them when they no longer serve a purpose?
I think ideally we'd have something like the Jubilee, right? Like once every 70 years, all the debts are cleared. It's like we just rip up the constitution, all the agreements are out the door, and we start again from scratch. And we say, okay, what seems to be important now? What do we need to pay attention to?
Well, in a similar way that like multicellular organisms often rebuild themselves from just a couple of cells, like they start afresh. Like if you want to change a cat into a cow, taking a fully grown cat and then trying to transform it into a cow is really complicated. Or you could go back to just a couple of cells and then turn it into a cow from like, the beginning of the process. And I don't know, have you seen any organizations transform themselves that way from like a renucleation process?
So I don't want to overstate this, but my opinion is that even a really high functioning group that has really efficient mechanisms for learning, I think a really good group cannot learn as quickly as a really good individual. That's been my experience so far, that like I've put a lot of my energy into trying to be at the frontiers and pioneering new ways of organizing. And still, like I have all of, like I mentioned at the start, I have all these different hats, all these different group identities, because the organization I started in 2010, like it's grown a lot, but it can't keep up with my personal trajectory, you know? It's like, and so then the one that I started in 2015, I got to start with a blank canvas and say, like, okay, based on all the lessons I did from the last one, what are the new decisions that I can make? They're going to be more intelligent, more efficient. And let's start again from scratch and go somewhere new. And it seems to me that like you can make, I seem like it feels to me that my organizations are evolving. There is this death process. There is this like it's, I don't know how to do it with one group. If you can take them through this whole trajectory that I've been on the last 15 years, or if I actually need five different groups that each last for 3 years to get, you know, like which one's the faster path. I suspect the latter option is the faster one.
Does this partly, like the way individuals interact with these groups, partly depend on the broader culture? And the way I think about this is if you have one group that does everything in your life and you get ejected from it or that structure becomes dysfunctional, the cost to you personally is enormous. And it becomes a kind of totalizing institution that takes over like your entire existence. And the stakes become like everything. Whereas if you are like more like a freelancer and you actually are involved in like three or four or five medium-sized groups, if one of them no longer serves your needs, it's easier to leave it. Or if it like blows up, oh, well, I lost 20% of my income, but it's not the end of the world. I'll just find, there's so many of these groups on that scale around that they become more disposable, which means they can afford to experiment and take more risks.
Yeah, this thing of the nested circles, like I always just keep coming back to it, because if you want to understand your system, you have to know what system you're inside of. And that system's inside of another one and another one. And it just keeps expanding until you include all of the universe and consciousness and everything else, you know? Absolutely, the broader culture and has a huge influence on what your organization looks like. I think a lot of people have suffered in organizations in the last decade, especially because of the like culture war stuff happening where there's certain discourses, there's certain controversial topics that seem like they knock on the door of your organization. If someone lets the door opens the door, it's like, oh wow, gosh, we have to make decisions about things. We have to find agreement on topics that seem to be extremely polarizing and challenging. And like that's just happening at a cultural level. It's not like any one organization or any one individual is like trying to make that happen. It's like an emergent property that's happening at a much larger scale. And we have to like engage intelligently with those sort of mega scale influence vectors that are out of our control, that we have some, we can respond to them intelligently, but we don't really get to control them. Again, that's I think a part of this, the skill of organization design is knowing how to keep some of those external factors out, or how to manage them, or how to anticipate that they're going to arrive, and you know, it's handle them strategically.
I guess that's almost like a mission creep problem. And is that also a problem of scale? Like smaller organizations are much easier to keep focused.
It is an issue of scale. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's easier when they're smaller. It's more that like to come back to the metaphor of the body, ideally all of the subgroups, all the subparts are really clear about what their role is, like what organ they are. And you don't want the liver to be playing a bladder role. It's really useful we separate those dynamics out and say, or if you're a liver tissue, go over there with the other liver tissues and be the liver organ. So that they can have clarity of purpose at the small scale, and that adds up to a coordinated system at a much larger, scale. But it's when they try and, you know, like for example, one of the reasons large groups can be really awful is when everyone wants to be involved in everything. It's like information overload, opinion overload, like death by committee. And you want to be able to delegate and sort of clarify the different departments, right?
Well, that brings up another really key topic that I've been trying to hone in on. The issues of like the critical point of filtering people coming into a group and the very unpleasant, well, traditionally unpleasant process of occasionally taking people out of the group, like having a clear boundary about who is in and who is out. And I think it, maybe this is more from like the 60s, 70s counterculture attempts at non-hierarchical group formation, that they went into that very naive. And a lot of those experiments kind of blew up very quickly. And it feels like this moment in history, we're kind of revisiting those ideas with much clearer eyes. And that issue of like, how do you manage recruitment? Do you have any, and filtering as well, if people get in and then you realize they're not a good fit.
Yeah.
What's your kind of philosophy on that? And can you see any new opportunities to do that better?
I mean, again, that's nested circles for me. So like that, something that has been a really robust pattern for Inspiral is to have multiple circles of engagement, and that you have a pretty low barrier of entry to get into the outer ring. That we're kind of porous at the edges and open to lots of different people showing up. And actually, if you're in the outer ring, one of the distinctive things at Inspiral is that you'll be surprisingly empowered. Will give you a lot of opportunities to have influence. Like we have a collective budgeting and spending process. And if you're in the outer ring, you're welcome to participate in that. And you could actually have quite a lot of influence out there. But the outer ring is a little bit of a getting to know you place. It's a bit like, you know, dating before you get married. It's like, we're getting to know, we're feeling each other out. We're trying to understand if we have alignment and values. And then you have an inner ring, which is much more of a higher barrier to entry and higher responsibilities over that threshold. And in our case, for the most part, people wouldn't be invited into that inner circle until after they've been through some kind of conflict. It's like, we know, you can pretty much guarantee that any relationship follows a kind of honeymoon and then a rupture. And then either at the end of the rupture, it's over, or there's a repair and you have this like anti-fragile, like extra closeness because you've gone through conflict together.
You're more confident you can deal with conflict again in the future because you understand how the other operates.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, I can trust that maybe you and I have a really bad day someday, but I can trust that in the following week we'll make the efforts to like come back together. And so once we've been through that experience together, then the relationship has actually been tested, and that's when you'd get invited into the inner circle. And it's the people in the inner circle that have the ultimate responsibility about, well, especially about the crucial question of who does get invited, you know, who gets invited into this group. So I think having this different stages of engagement with increasing responsibility as you get closer to the core, that feels like a very natural pattern for me. And then, like you're saying about filtering people out, I think there's a way to do what one of the key architects of Inspiral, Alana Irving, she uses this phrase about I don't know if I can get the exact wording right, but she talks about like that to stay in a position of responsibility, it's like you have to slightly swim against the current, that actually we're by default, everyone is going to get removed from this group. Like every 6 months or something, there's going to be this very low touch, but we're going to check in with you and say like, are you still here? You're still present, you're still active, you're still up for taking these extra responsibilities. And actually the default pressure is no, you're out. And you have to proactively recommit and say, no, I'm definitely in, I'm in. Yeah. So instead of like a marriage where it's like you do that one wedding day and then it's forever, it's more like some kind of constant process of recommitment every 6 months. And that I think has been really healthy, that we just have the expectation that conflict is going to happen. More importantly, I think just life changes and priorities are going to change. People are going to go through different transitions where they're no longer prioritizing this in the way that they used to be. And when that happens, they shouldn't be in positions of power. They shouldn't have extra leadership. just because they used to, or just because they feel, you know, some emotional, they feel bonded to the group. That doesn't mean that they should actually be in a position of influence. So like having the default set up so that like leaving is the norm, or at least stepping to an outer ring is the norm. I think that's really healthy.
I'm looking at that as well. Like the way it traditionally happens is it builds up to a crisis point, and then it becomes like a personal, unusual thing that happens to just that person. Whereas if it's part of the institutional culture that there's like a regular turnover and reassessment, then it isn't personal. It's organizational, and you go into that organization knowing that's the culture. Rather than suddenly waking up one day and, oh no, you're the bad person that everybody hates. It's a much healthier dynamic. I had one idea for building a culture of networking these usually very independent plant breeders. And it's almost like, the idea is that people start out with a formal invitation from one person who's already part of the network. So they've got like one contact point. And that would be suitable for someone who's like just getting into doing crop breeding and they're interested, but they don't have a lot of experience. And then maybe at most once per year, they can have another person in the group connect to them. So now they have two connections, and there might be an upper limit to how many connections a person is supposed to have to avoid that over-centralization that you end up with one really like switched on, very outgoing, motivated person who suddenly has like hundreds of connections. But then when they get sick or life changes, you lose all of those connections at once and it damages the whole network. And I know people tend to burn out because they overestimate how much they can commit to. So I'm leaning towards that kind of a model that I'm trying to build to just make it. I mean, it's not even like a set of rules. It's so decentralized that you can't police it. But I mean, that's kind of the ideal that I'm aiming for, that it is so decentralized that once you have those basic, very simple recipes and rules and guidelines in place, it allows those networks to grow and to maintain resilience. I think that's ultimately what I'm aiming for.
I mean, this, I think, is a good example of this key dilemma of organizational design. We always talk about minimum viable structure.
Mm.
Like, what's the minimum stuff that we have to have consensus on that enables this sweet spot between coordination and freedom? And maybe what you've just described is in the minimum set, you know, and that's like, we need to have this. Or maybe it's like over-engineered and is anticipating a problem that doesn't actually turn out to be very significant for you and limits people in an annoying way, you know, and we don't know which one it's going to be. A lot of the stuff, again, if you're operating at a reasonably small scale, it's like you don't necessarily need a rule about it, but it's something that you're anticipating could be an issue. Yeah. And you can just have a conversation once a year and say, hey, I've noticed that all of our connections seem to be centralized on you and Jim, and it's a bit of it's a failure mode we're going to be take care of. And it's the question of, will you govern by rules or by memes here? You know, so like I briefly touched on the meme of the hermit crabs that we have. And one of my networks, and the idea of hermit crabs, I don't know if you've seen this, this like really beautiful 5-minute clip from it's like David Attenborough narrating this process where there's all these hermit crabs that line up on the beach in order of size on a certain day of the year, and they all like they're like feeling out each other's little shells to see how big the shell is. They line up in order of size, and then they all kind of in a coordinated move step out of their shell with their like pink fleshy body, and then they go and they move into the next shell that's bigger. And this is like hilarious, unbelievably coordinated thing that's happening, you know, through emergent processes in nature, where at the end of the process, all of the crabs get a bigger shell and they got more room to move. And we use this metaphor for like how we think of leadership essentially, and how do we do succession and leadership, which is like in an organization, you're going to have loads of different points of leadership. So like, let's say it's, I'm one of the ones who's responsible for this retreat center. And then there's that's a really big shell. I'm a hermit crab with a great big shell. It's like, oh, it's a big responsibility, both in terms of budget and time commitment and the amount of people that I'm responsible for. It's like a big responsibility. And then there's a sub responsibility, which is managing the kitchen. And then there's an even smaller responsibility, which is managing the guests for this one event, which lasts for 3 days, you know? So there's like different scales of different magnitudes of responsibility. And whichever one you're operating at, part of your job, like once you've mastered the, say, the kitchen thing or the looking after the room transitions or whatever your job is, as soon as you've reached a level of comfort in your responsibility, your job is to find the next crab that's going to take your shell. And say, like, okay, this is what's worked for me. These are our objectives. These are the kind of patterns that have worked for me. Make it your own. And for the maybe for the first iteration, I'll be in charge and you'll be my apprentice. For the second iteration, you'll be in charge and I'll be in the background available to help if you like. And then for the third iteration, you've got it. And being quite systematic about that for us has been, that's where our robustness has come, I think. That like you're not centralizing key information. It's that, well, where are the trash bags or whatever you need to do your job well, that information gets passed along in that process.
It's a little bit like the three emperors from Asimov's Foundation, that there was like an elder, a middle, and a younger clone of the same ancestral person who are constantly learning to take on each other's duties as they aged out.
Yeah, so specifically that. We think of it in terms of like you have your peers, you have your mentors, and you have your apprentices. And I think a really healthy developmental context, everyone is going to have all of those three slots filled.
I'm curious as well about, I guess I'd put this under the umbrella of rehabilitating hierarchy, that egalitarianism and like dispersed structures are really wonderful some of the time, but slime molds, their life cycles, that they spend like a large amount of time as individual cells, like just hunting for bacteria on the forest floor. And then when conditions change, they all signal and suddenly come together into something that's like much more complicated and hierarchical than they were before. And they can go back and forth. I think there were some native tribes in the Americas that when conditions were good, they'd settle down and become agriculturalists for half the year, and then have really strict pecking order about who was in charge of what. And then the bad time of the year, they'd turn back into hunter-gatherers, and nobody could boss anyone around. And I'm curious if that kind of dynamic shifting. Oh, and Rome as well, when they were in war for a while, would have a dictator who like just took the reins and made everything happen, with the idea that they would always let go, and eventually they didn't let go, and that kind of caused all of those problems. So yeah, it's not without its hazards, but I'm wondering if any organizations you've worked with have that kind of dynamic between hierarchy and dispersion.
I mean, there's a really great book, The Dawn of Everything, by David Graeber and David Wingrove, and they describe this pattern emerging again and again and again at different points in history and different societies, and I find it quite compelling. And I mean, it's been, without having read that book or without having had that objective in mind, it's where like organically a bunch of my organizations have evolved towards, is this oscillation between the more anarchistic libertarian mode and then the more authoritarian mode, you know, and that there's a it's like peacetime democracy and wartime dictatorship. There's some peace in war, but it's like kind of good times and crisis moments or something like that. So in the most practical example, it's like when I'm running an event, say we have 50 people together for a week and we're doing some stuff together, like the good times, the normal case is it's very anarchistic. It's really like people can leadership can come from anywhere. Like the agenda is assembled by all the people that are there. Whoever has the impulse to lead something would lead something. That most of the time, like 95% of the time, we're operating in this really kind of democratic, dispersed, open way, horizontal way. And then occasionally you'll have a crisis, like, oh, someone's a bad actor. Like someone here is really not. They're operating in a way which is like fundamentally counter to the principles and the objectives of this thing. And they need to leave. And doing that, making that decision, making that analysis, and then that decision, and then executing on the decision to for someone to leave, doing that by consensus, it just doesn't happen. Like it's just impossible to get a group, or if you could do it, it would take so much time and energy to build that agreement. Whereas if you have one or two people that are highly trusted by the rest of the group, that it's saying, hey, you've got some emergency powers, you know, in case of emergency, break glass and use the red hammer. Like that model just seems to work for us really well. And most of the people that are at that kind of gathering they don't want to be responsible for these decisions about who should be there and who shouldn't be there. Like having the ability to say, hey, can you handle this?
Is
It's
that
really efficient for everyone.
intuition, that reluctance to make those decisions collectively, a reflection of the risk of poisoning the well? That, like, if everybody is aware that this collective mood can spread that kicks one person out, it's always kind of hanging over everyone's head. It's like, am I doing something? Is it going to be me next? Whereas if you know it's a more, I don't know, structured, externalized kind of process from the group dynamic, it might, I don't know. I can see how that makes it more healthy, and it's a more time-limited thing. Once the crisis is averted, you move back into like that collective happy mode. Another possible response to a crisis, A/B testing, to actually like split the organization temporarily and say, let's kind of t make this a fun competition where we take different approaches to see if we can solve this problem, but with a view of coming back together to compare our notes and then either pick the better of the two options or a synthesis. There might be some combination of things that neither group could have discovered on their own.
Yes, so long as you're really careful about how the A/B testing interacts with sort of dynamics around tribalism. You know, like people will find any excuse, the smallest difference, to say, I'm identified with team A, you know,
That
and it's, we're
lingers.
not like those inferior team
It's
B's.
like the blue eye experiment.
I don't know the end of the story, but my parents' church, they split in half around kind of COVID vaccine and masking and stuff like this. And they're in the process of trying to reintegrate afterwards. And I don't know where they're going to get to with that. But I can easily imagine how you make the pragmatic step and you say, okay, people that are really safety conscious, you go in group A, and people that are more liberal, you go in group B. And ideally, there's a process where you come back together at the end. But you can imagine that people's sort of fears and projections and their tribal identities forming and being like, oh, the problem is those conservative people in group A, and they're the root of all of our problems, you know.
It's another one of those situations where you have to do that structure before it reaches the breaking point if you're going to have any hope of reintegrating afterwards. Like you almost have to be fighting people to do the split. They're like, no, we don't need to do this. And then you're like, yeah, now I know it is safe to do it because they actually want to get back together.
And on some issues, you could do more of a like sortition basis, or like a random assignment, where it's like, if your surname is between A and H, you know, you're going to run this rule set, and if it's this other group, can run this other rule set, and then we'll compare. And you're not actually choosing into which group you're in. I think that would have different dynamics.
Speaking of rule sets and cultural DNA, the easy thing to do is a kind of evolutionary kind of one tweak at a time, searching for the local optimum. But have you considered that there might be islands of stability in this really complex, like million-dimensional phase space that no human society has like stumbled into, just kind of groping around for like the next best solution? That there could be like completely different ways of organizing human societies that nobody's even thought about, and like how would we ever find them?
I think this is the original story behind Burning Man. You know, that it's like, we're gonna go out beyond the reach of typical society, and we're gonna set up a different set of principles about how we treat each other, and we're gonna see if we can make a society that's sustainable. And then we'll see, is it more fun? Is it more interesting? Does it have, what happens when you run that experiment? And I think that's a good example of how it's like a reasonably clean break. You know, things like there's no money changing hands. I mean, immediately that hugely changes dynamics with people. I think that's it's worthwhile doing those kind of radical breaks. But it's also extremely dangerous. You know, like the reason that we make these conservative changes is because, well, what happens when you get rid of the concept of policing or of rules? Well, you have people driving drunk and firing guns at each other and doing like, what if we do chicken down the desert while we're shooting it? It's like, okay, I'm glad that some people have the freedom to go and do that, but I want to be kept from a safe distance. So like,
Do you
maybe
think
that's an absurd example, but.
the growth of digital communities is like a unique opportunity to make these kind of wild experiments? Keeping in mind that like translating that back to in-person arrangements may not always work. But yeah, like I don't know, are you seeing interesting things with social experimentation happening in digital spaces, or is it yet to come?
It is happening. The thing is, like I said about, you're always part of a bigger system. Like the bigger culture that you're in always shows up and knocks on the door. So there's only so much distance you can take. Like Burning Man these days, I haven't been, but I understand it's like pretty commercialized in many respects. It's like we're still part of capitalism and we're still in a market-based economy. Those dynamics have shaped us for generations. Like they're gonna show up. I think there's been some interesting, like we're obviously really early days in the process of digital culture formation, like really early days. But we are seeing something interesting. Like I'm part of I guess it's more accurate to call it a scene rather than a community. We call it Teapot, this part of Twitter. And that's an intentionally vague name because what do you mean this part of Twitter? Well, it's like the part that we're in with these people. It doesn't really have a boundary, but there are some distinctive social norms there that I've seen that I haven't seen replicated elsewhere that seem really wholesome for some. So I don't know if I can encapsulate it briefly, but I think there's a shared implicit sense that any group and any medium of communication has a carrying capacity for dissent. So like you and I, we've just met and we're on Zoom. I might disagree with you a little bit, but not very much. Like I'm still in the process of like getting to know you and trying to be friends, But if we were face to face and you spent a week here, after day two or three, I would start to say, oh, I think that idea is dumb, and we'd get into it in a constructive way. And I think in this teapot scene, there's been this like quite a healthy understanding of when is it useful to disagree, what topics you just actually like. There's a bunch of topics that it's just better not to discuss online in public because you're just going to start all these flame wars and no one's going to learn anything. You better just like quietly turn your eye to those topics and say, that's your private. We don't know what you think on this. What do you think about Donald Trump or whatever is the thing that seems to make people explode? We just like quietly tiptoe around those issues and focus on, well, given the medium that we're communicating in and given the depth of relationship that we have with each other, where are the topics that we can talk about and actually learn from each other and do something constructive? And I've seen that happen in Teapot in a way that I haven't seen in any other group. And it's really distinctive, especially in the last 5 years where so many groups have ruptured over cultural issues and this one hasn't. And it's like, huh, okay, that's a really healthy sign. And I expect there must be thousands of these groups around the world, or each of them optimizing for one little issue that is completely illegible to me, but they're nailing it. And I'm excited about what happens over the coming decades, as digital culture matures and we have this exchange going on between different groups.
I mean, that's the paradox of digital communities. We've got, on one hand, the algorithmic selected, like viral, hitting, millions of people, content that's usually very like lacking in any nutritional value. But we've also got tools that allow us to like curate these tiny little like bespoke communities on a global scale that was never possible before. Like I'm meeting the most amazing people and interacting with them regularly, but you have to make an effort to do that to break out of the trance. But I read a really interesting article that pointed out that digital communities are like feudal absolute monarchies, because there always has to be somebody who like created the space, and they basically have absolute power. They can kick anyone out, they can burn the whole thing to the ground. But it's interesting because that digital space isn't a territory like a traditional kind of geopolitical one. The people are the community. They are the territory. Like you have to convince people to come and join in and participate. And if you can't do that, you can be as autocratic as you like, and it'll just be you.
And so this is the thing where the feudalism metaphor kind of doesn't hold up very well, because like I mentioned Teapot, this part of Twitter. Okay, well it's not even called Twitter anymore, but we still call it Teapot. And any day Elon Musk could decide to shut that website down and it would have an effect on this scene or this community, but it wouldn't destroy it. Like the people would migrate. Like we've got enough different means of communication with each other that we'll just assemble on Blue Sky, or we'll assemble on Substack, or we'll assemble in person. Like you say, I love that expression that the people are the territory in this case. And the norms are really different when you've got abundant space, right? Like where you're not actually limited by this number of acres that you've got that
Yeah,
you
there
can
isn't some
control.
little island that you're fighting tooth and nail, because if you get kicked off it, you're going to die. There's infinite number of islands. You've just got to pick one that has people on it that you care to associate with. Now I've got another interesting idea that I want to run past you. So we live on a practical level in extremely atomized societies. Like we all do everything for ourselves. And in the recent, up until the recent past, that was relatively affordable for the average person. But with changing economic pressures, there's more and more incentive to reclaim economies of scale. And I think this was like the ideal with like the sharing community that like rather than everyone having a crazy fancy washing machine that sits idle like 99% of the time, you could actually coordinate to like be more economically efficient on like all these different scales. But the problem is trust. And also that modern people aren't very well enculturated for forming those kind of trusting associations with people. And it got me wondering if there could be something like an interpersonal decentralized blockchain that is like a record of all of your good relations that you've had in the past that is robust enough that you can actually go to a stranger, a neighbor that you've never talked to much before, and say, here is proof that I'm a trustworthy person. Here are the contacts of all of these people that I've interacted with, and you can verify any of them. They could even be like transcripts of like, thousands of conversations that you've had that their AI can analyze and say, yeah, this person, seems to be good. And it allows you to like bridge those gaps and form very focused economy of scale groups with relative strangers with ease. It's that issue of trust. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts about that crazy idea of mine?
Well, I mean, the jury is out whether that kind of system can, like, once you make a system of reputation and trust like that legible and verifiable and like concrete, you know, that it's like you're either in or you're out, or you've got 100 points or you've got 73 points. The jury's out whether we can create systems, regularized systems like that where the benefits outweigh the costs.
Yeah, it could become
That
very dystopian if you get some of the starting conditions wrong.
it may be that the best system we can come up with is the implicit neighborhood, people who know people who know people. It's like in this house that we're in here, I'm expecting over the year we'll have probably 1,000 guests, members of 40 or 50 different networks. And I am the kind of person who can kind of know something about all of those 1,000 people. I play that kind of role in the system where I'm like got this exaggeratedly large mental Rolodex and can kind of play a role to be like a diplomat that connects between different communities. And so it's like, oh, I know Shane, and you haven't met Shane, but I have. And so, it's like I can sort of manage the extraordinary amount of data and complexity. When you say trust, it's like, well, trust them for what? Like, with what degrees of freedom? Like that. It might just. I'm the jury. Like I say, the jury's out. It might just be that the sort of tribal elder is the best we can come up with. That literally might be the best we can come up with. And that when you put things into spreadsheets, that the kind of conformity pressure and the coercion and the risk of. Yeah, like you said, the authoritarian dynamics, it's like, well, what if instead of we're calling this a decentralized, trust for blockchain scorecard, it's the social credit score. Then suddenly like, oh, social credit score. I mean, this is the technique that we can use to like control our enemies and make sure that everyone aligns with one set of beliefs.
Yeah. Well, see, here's the way I look at it. If this becomes technologically possible, then centralized authorities will do it first if decentralized people don't take it up themselves. And one of those two models is probably going to end up becoming the functional default. And it's just a kind of matter of a race who gets there first. But I mean, I even thought about it in terms of like voluntary radical transparency. Like we have the technology that you could record your entire life and then make that available for AI to analyze. I mean, imagine a political party that was their platform, that all of our candidates are going to be like completely transparent in a way that is like makes corruption basically impossible. Imagine
There's a
how
book. There's
disruptive
a
that
I
could be.
forgot the name of the book. There's a novel with exactly that premise.
Oh, there you go.
I think it's a really interesting concept. I definitely think stuff like this is happening, and that like. It's actually where I get a lot of hope for when I look at the ways that politics seems to be stuck. It's like, I think there's going to be transformations like that where people compete in terms of legitimacy. I think that's one of the things that has really stagnated the political system a lot, is just like this crisis of legitimacy, like who's worth paying attention to, and like, why should I delegate my power to you? But yeah, I did notice the older I get, the more I sort of lean towards this sort of Luddite posture of like, yeah, you know, I'm in this neighborhood in Catalonia with like an extended family that kind of owns the whole valley, and like, maybe that's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
That's about as, you know, advanced as we can go.
You do have to keep at the back of your mind with all of this technology that we could be one solar storm away from losing it. Like, it could just disappear overnight, and then what would we fall back on? If you can't wash your clothes because you no longer have a memory of whether somebody is trustworthy, that could be a problem.
Yeah, what we fall back on is like, well, did Jim come and help me clear the logs when the tree fell over in the storm last winter or not? You know, you wind up with this very immediate material proximity.
I did miss one question I wanted to ask before about the issue of recruiting people into groups. Do you think there's potential for refining things like psychometric tests, the foundation for like behavioral analysis seems to be like being boiled down to some relatively robust principles, and I wonder if that could be linked to an understanding of group dynamics, that you specific groups could get better at getting, you know, increasing their hit rate of identifying suitable people, rather than just doing it based on vibes, because like, not everyone has your level of vibe mechanic skills.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I haven't really thought about it that way, but it makes sense to me that basically better personality tests could make it more efficient to know who's a good fit for your group. Because it's like, I'm highly sensitive to it, right? So it's obvious to me when someone is, I can make a split second decision, and I think a lot of the times it's like a good enough decision. I don't know if it's perfect, but it's like, I'm looking for people who take responsibility for themselves, and they're kind of considerate about what's going on around them, and they're sort of thinking about other people. And, you know, there's a handful of values that I really care about that seem to be essential for the kind of collaborations I want to be involved in. And you can see markers of those values very, very quickly. Just in the first hour of someone showing up in your physical space around you, you can immediately see like, oh, okay, this person's off in their own world, and they might have certain brilliances and talents, but I'm not going to expect them to be considerate. Yeah, I can imagine that you can automate some of that or standardize some of that and make it more efficient. And again, you come back to the same question about, can you create structure that's not, that serves life, you know, that's like, that serves the creative process, that helps you to learn and stay fluid, instead of, you know, you sort of have this phenomenon in education of teaching to the test. It's like, oh, we know that we're going to check you on this and this and this mark. You know, the kind of person who offers everyone a cup of tea when they arrive. Okay, so then everyone when they arrive, they're like, cup of tea, cup of tea, cup of tea. You know,
what's that rule, Godwin's rule or something? Like, when you make something a metric, then people just game that metric.
Yeah,
I think it's one of those rules. An alternative, possibly more human and organic approach to this would be, if somebody like you in an organization is really good at this critical role of acting as the cell membrane around the group, do you like have somebody shadowing you in that role so that they can actually learn how to do it? Because it's one of these kind of metis kind of intangible abilities, and having someone shadowing you, seeing you make those decisions, is it something that can be absorbed by osmosis if it can't actually be written down in like a set of rules?
Yeah, it totally can. I think this goes for lots of different metas. Yeah, this sort of implicit knowledge, which comes along with mastery and expertise, it can be taught, and it is by shadowing. It's like, if someone has less experience with it, you can ask them, hey, how would you decide on this topic? And get them to narrate their thought process, and then you can contrast it with your thought process and say, like, these are the things that I'm noticing. And I think you can transmit the implicit, ineffable, you know, the sort of like, there's a subtle network of different points that I'm paying attention to, which gives me the conclusion that this person is not a good fit for us and is actually a threat. I think you can communicate some of that. And it's this like gradual process of refinement. And absolutely, I wouldn't trust me to be the cell membrane. You know, it's going to be me plus a few people. There's got to be checks and balances because my biases are like blatant.
Oh, no, that's really interesting to think about. Let me think. What else is on my list? Oh, yes, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the power of cultural schismogenesis in group identity formation. And can this be used for in productive, like healthy ways? And like we talked about like splitting groups into like A/B testing and then how hard it can be to like reintegrate them back together if they form a new group identity as being, oh, we're not the same as those people over there. But yeah, is there a way or like even a synthetic way, like you, can you create a like an artificial outgroup as an opposite to what you want in the in-group? I mean, it's almost like the devil. Like if the devil didn't exist, then the church would have to invent him.
That's really interesting, dude. I've had some of these thoughts before, and I'm like, "Ooh, it seems like spicy territory." That it does seem like okay. So I'm trying to organize. I'm trying to invite people into a pluralistic kind of belonging, where to me, the in-group out-group dynamic is so tiresome, and like it's like a. For example, with politics, it just like so deeply obscures our view of reality because we're just so preoccupied with which team we're on and making sure that we're on the right team all the time. We don't actually care about the facts. We don't actually care about what policies are real. That we're so preoccupied with that. And I get really frustrated. And so I try to build communities where we can have a much more pluralistic sense of belonging, that we're not so obsessed about the out-group and being the in-group. And it's like we're actively trying to cultivate our tolerance of each other and be excited about our differences and celebrate when someone dissents, you know, like that's the kind of mode that I'm operating in. But then I do have this voice in me that says, yeah, but maybe I'm swimming against the tide, you know, in an idealistic way that's not actually grounded in reality. And the in-group out-group thing is just a fundamental dynamic of what it's like to be a mammal. And how can we just harness that and work with it in a more intelligent way? And like you say, intentionally design an out-group and say, we're not that. Maybe that's a really healthy thing. You know, maybe that's a useful mechanism.
Here's a fun way that you could possibly do this. So if you can see a like a culture war schism threatening your harmonious organization, you could parody, personify that schism itself as the outgroup of these two people or these
That's
two groups of
great.
people ridiculously fighting over something that probably doesn't matter that much at the end of the day, so that your group can identify as not being caught into that split.
I love it. I love it. Listen, I mean, it shows you like there is a role, I think, for like irony, for theater, for performance, for clowning, this kind of like humor, like that we have got these mechanisms again, like ancient cultural DNA that we have, like the jester that gets to flip the hierarchy on its head and make fun of the king. Like that is a really wholesome mechanism. Like it really works for good reason. And
But the timing has to be perfect. It's like making a joke about somebody after they've died. Like there's a, if you do it like on the day of their funeral, it's probably, it has to be a really good joke to get away with that, or a really carefully thought out joke. But as time goes on, it becomes more manageable. And I think it would be the same. You'd have to see those kind of split issues coming a mile off before they've started to manifest within the group. And like, yeah, dangerous. It's dangerous magic.
I love it. I love it. I like the way you think.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think, is there anything else that I should have asked you that I haven't kind of stumbled across? Do you have any things that come to mind? I've probably kept you as long as I could reasonably
That's the
expect.
thing. There's like a you've touched a million very interesting topics, and I'm like, oh, okay, I've got to go next door and sand that window frame and start painting pretty soon. I'm like alternating in my mind between these fascinating topics and the practical logistics of this house.
Well, I'll wrap off then. We'll wrap it up. So, do you want to let people know where they can find out more about your work, where to get the book that I you wanted me to say this, I mentioned it before. HR departments, human resources departments and corporations are like the devil. The world that I got a glimpse into through Better Work Together, the book that I bought through Inspiral, is like the heavenly counterpart of that kind of demonic domain of HR goblins, like scurrying around and making everyone anxious. It was quite remarkable. I read the whole damn thing, and I found all sorts of interesting things that I'm going to take away into my own experiments in my domain. So tell us more about everything that you want to plug.
That's great, Shane. Yeah, the heavenly realms of HR. So that book, Better Work Together, you can find it at betterworktogether.co. That's the website. And then, yeah, I've got a lot of other websites as well. I think if you go to richdecibels.com, that's my personal website, which links out to a lot of my organizations and things that I've written and my Twitter page and all this sort of stuff. And then if you're interested in this space that I mentioned, if you go to eltilo.casa, that's the webpage for our retreat center. We're starting at the end of this month to have co-living weeks. So it's like, come and hang out with us outside of Barcelona in the forest for a week and meet really awesome people and have these kinds of conversations and have a really lovely time in community living for a week at a time. Go to eltilo.casa to find out about that.
If I could put all my goats on a plane, I would be there. Well,
yeah, we haven't figured out that technology yet.
Well, Rich, thank you very much for being very generous with your time and letting me throw all of these crazy questions at you. It's been wonderful.
That's really fun, Shane. It feels like meeting one of the extended family, you know, like, oh, you like this stuff too. Great. Yeah, I'm really happy to be part of it.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me. Or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.